Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. With some guests, an intro could go on for days, and that's the case for Dr. Merit Mendefro, an Ethiopian-American primary care physician, anthropologist, and filmmaker. She is president of TruthAid, a media company she co-founded with Lacey Schwartz, who's also been a guest on this program. It was born out of the experience of doctors working to prevent HIV/AIDS in the South Bronx. Merit's work with HIV-positive women became the subject of a 2008 feature-length documentary, All of Us. She also produced and co-wrote Little White Lie, Lacey's 2014 documentary about family secrets and identity. TruthAid is the co-producer of Defret, which recently won the Audience Award at Sundance and the Berlin International Film Festival. The movie is based on the true story of a young Ethiopian girl and a tough and passionate lawyer. They join forces in a life-or-death clash between culture and the advancement of equal rights. Angelina Jolie is the film's executive producer. Dr. Mendefro received her BA in anthropology and her MD from Harvard, a Master of Science in the Public Health of Developing Countries at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, as a Fulbright scholar. She began her career working extensively with HIV-infected and affected communities in New York, Botswana, Ethiopia, and South Africa. In 2009, President Obama appointed her a White House Fellow. She worked on health policy issues for veterans who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Merit, I'm exhausted. Welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me today.
So it's really not easy to characterize you, is it?
I think it is, but yes, it's true that my career hasn't been a straight line. I've stayed relatively open to life, and I kind of jump when I believe I need to. So that's meant a zigzag in my case.
You were not born in this country.
No, I was not. I was born in Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. I came when I was about a year and a half. My father was political in Ethiopia.
He had to leave?
Yeah, he had to leave. There was a revolution and a coup, and they tried to kill him. And so there was an assassination attempt, and we came here. And I grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, and have been, you know, I consider myself an American very much in the way I move in this world.
Was it very difficult for your family to come here? Was this some kind of an underground, circuitous route to get to the States?
It wasn't. It almost was. You know, I was going to be kind of smuggled out to Senegal, and I think I still have a Senegalese passport somewhere from when I was a baby. But as luck would have it, there were different factions in the government at the time. Some supported my father, and actually my father came as ambassador first to the United States.
The ambassador from Ethiopia?
Yeah, to the United States under Carter. And then there was still plots to kind of take his life because he was, you know, at this time Ethiopia was becoming a communist government, essentially. Mm-hmm. And there was a period of history called the Red Terror that was really terrible and was about to begin. And so he kind of disassociated ties and stayed here. And our house, all our assets got taken, et cetera. So we became refugees in this country, actually. And from that point on, my parents just kind of built a new life here. They couldn't go back. They were blacklisted. So we actually couldn't go back to Ethiopia until I was in college, and the government changed again in the 90s. It wasn't safe for us to go back until then. So,
do you still have family there?
I do. I have aunts, uncles, cousins, and, you know, my parents now go back and forth, actually. Mm-hmm.
Freely?
Yeah, freely. Mm-hmm. So I actually started going back to Ethiopia as soon as I could, like in the late 90s, and have been going back ever since.
And Ethiopia is one of the places that I mentioned that you were doing HIV work,
correct? Yeah, that's where I actually did my graduate work in medical anthropology on looking at women's experiences of stigma, HIV-positive women's experiences of stigma in Ethiopia. I was working with the International Center for Research on Women on a really interesting study where they were looking at women's diaries, actually. They were basically looking at diaries over a year period to see, you know, the different kinds of experiences women were having. And those stories were actually incredibly rich, as you can imagine, and eye-opening. And that's kind of when I really got into stories, in all honesty, and storytelling.
Did you always know that you wanted to be a doctor?
Yeah, I think I wanted to be a doctor from a very young age, relatively young age. And then I got to college and I met other pretty amazing doctors that really influenced the way I thought.
And inspired you?
And inspired me. One doctor that deserves to be mentioned, the late Jonathan Mann, who's considered the father of health and human rights. And then Paul Farmer, who is a physician and anthropologist. And I basically wanted to be Paul, which is why I kind of pursued both of those lanes. And then life happens and you see things and you start doing things. In my case, my residency in the South Bronx was a pretty radicalizing time in my life. I had done a lot of HIV public health work even before residency. My clinic was situated in what's considered the poorest urban congressional district of America. And what I saw in that primary clinic was really eye-opening. And it left me feeling like, you know, doctors intervene a little too late in people's lives and that there was a lot, especially with the HIV epidemic.
But that was a neglected and still is a neglected community, isn't it?
It is. It is. And there's many pockets like that all over America. But in particular, I was really frustrated at the disproportionate rates of HIV in Black women and what we were saying about that discourse. And that's actually how I started making films. I wanted to start saying something very different and more honest about the epidemic than what I thought we were being taught.
Was there a big difference between the problems of women in Ethiopia who were diagnosed with HIV/AIDS and the women in the South Bronx?
Well, at that time, there was a huge difference because there was no access to treatment in Ethiopia, which meant HIV really was a death sentence. And I think that completely changes the way people respond to it.
You know, why bother, you mean?
Absolutely. Why bother? Why get tested? There's mm-hmm. no hope, mm-hmm. you know? And I also think that more access to treatment you have, inherently prevention will also be better, obviously. I mean, before the current era where there's actually access to treatment in a lot of places in sub-Saharan Africa, for every, like, one person we were getting on treatment, six people were getting infected. So there's this huge kind of, you know, divide between prevention and treatment. So at that time, there was a big difference in Ethiopia versus what was happening in the South Bronx. Mm-hmm. But there were some things that were similar, which had everything to do with kind of the social context women were put in and how the lack of agency they had over their lives, how dependent they were on their partners for economic means, which meant they couldn't, you know, force them to put on condoms or leave really horrible relationships, et cetera, which puts you in a situation of increased risk. And that was the same story in the South Bronx.
And also, women are so dispensable.
We're still far away from, you know, true gender equality, mm-hmm. right, in all of these places. And that certainly plays itself out, everything from dynamics in the bedroom to, you know, the kind of access to economic opportunities that women have in their lives, right?
Stunning that it's 2015 and right. we're still talking about this.
Right. And but what we know in 2015 is that if you do empower women, you give them access to economic opportunities, the dividends and what it yields is for the entire family, mm-hmm. right? Especially in places like Ethiopia.
Of course.
Right. So
under whose auspices did you wind up going to Botswana and Ethiopia and South Africa to do your work?
Right. So in Ethiopia, I was working with the International Center for Research on Women, which is a big think tank mm-hmm. that's based in D.C., actually. In Botswana, I was working for the Harvard AIDS Partnership, Botswana AIDS Partnership, which was a partnership. I went to Harvard Medical School. So it was through a grant I had gotten to do that work. In South Africa, it was also through Harvard, a grant that I had gotten there.
You started in medicine, a mm-hmm. practicing physician, mm-hmm. in community work. Mm-hmm. And then what happened to you?
Like I said, I jump when I see things that are really, that I believe in. Mm-hmm. And I think that when there are opportunities to make an impact. And I think in the case of HIV, at the time, a filmmaker had approached me about, you know, making this film and knew about my work. And
all
research.
Of Us?
Yeah.
All the documentary
yeah, the
that
documentary
features you.
That features me and it features my patients. So that was a really kind of eye-opening experience because I was kind of on an academic medicine path at that mm-hmm. point, you know. And, you know, as an academic, you can make one paper and like maybe 10 people can read it.
Or you can make a movie.
Make a movie and yeah. millions mm-hmm. of people see it. And that's literally what happened, in, you know, over the course of those 3 years. And so I started making that film in 2004-5 and it came out in 2008. So this is about 10 years ago now. So at that point, I actually started the company Truth Aid to do all the film outreach work with that, you know, because you can make a film and kind of go on to your next film. But I was a believer, and I still am, and this is why our partnership with Lacey works so well. You know, what you do with the film after you've made it is almost just as important in terms of leading the conversation.
Absolutely.
Right? And so Truth Aid really grew out of this whole idea of using film as a tool of public engagement, you know, really to have
an
some
education.
Kind of an education. So I literally went on like, I don't know, for 2 years, I toured all over the country having these community conversations using the film and trying to get to a kind of a different level of understanding, raising awareness. And, I loved it. You know, I was really good at that work. And that just led to more work. And it's at that time that we actually started, I started working on Little White Lie.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Merit Mandefro, who is a primary care physician, anthropologist, and filmmaker. So at that point, what did you do? Just put your practice on hold?
At that point, what had
happened? Good God, woman, there's only 24 hours in a day.
I know. So what had happened is I actually ended up taking a faculty position. I wrote a grant as part of this interdisciplinary program that the Robert Wood Health Johnson Foundation.
In New Jersey?
But this is the largest philanthropic foundation that funds health and healthcare in America, and they're called the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. They had a human capital program called the Health and Society Scholars Program. It actually doesn't exist in the same way, but they funded basically forward-leaning thinkers to think outside the box when it came to what we call the social determinants of health, right? So this idea that there's a lot of causes and factors that lead to actually healthy populations. And medical care is only a piece of that story, right? It's the other things we've been talking about, like economic opportunity, access to education, levels of violence, all these other things that end up determining population health. And so Robert Wood Johnson Foundation funded me for 2 years, which meant I was on research faculty at the University of Pennsylvania, and I wrote a grant that allowed me to explore the public health uses of media. And that grant is how I started Truth Aid.
Was that your idea first, or you and Lacey Schwartz gave birth to it simultaneously?
No, that grant was my idea, and I wrote that grant. But I was talking with Lacey about it the whole time, and she, the lights went off because she was making her film, and she obviously also has kind of a diverse background like mine, a non-traditional filmmaker's background. She went to law school. I was in medical school. We were both at Harvard, and we were both great friends, and we both realized we're both using media very much in the same way.
Right.
And I had just completed All of Us, which, my experience of being in front of the camera.
Yeah.
And she was about to do this intense experience of being in front of the camera, too. And so it was like
the stars were aligned.
Exactly. The stars are aligned. I got the grant. And then we were like, okay, let's go. Let's do this. And so I'm very thankful to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Had I not had those 2 years or that protected time or that grant, Truth Aid probably wouldn't exist, in all honesty.
And those years were when?
That was 2007 to 2009.
So that brings me to 2009 when you're named a White House Fellow by President Obama. You know what I feel next to you? Do you know the French word for aunt is néant? I'm just, giving you a hard time. But you just are one-woman band.
Yeah.
So how did that come to pass that you wound up BFFs with Barack Obama?
Me and Barack.
Yeah, my good friend Barack. Yeah.
So like I said, I stayed relatively open. I mean, after residency, what became very clear was that, a career in medicine was not going to be enough for me. I really wanted to change the situations that led to poor health, which, as a primary care physician, you intervene so late in life. In people's lives, and so many of these problems and factors is what we call upstream in public health came, way before they were sick, actually. And so I really didn't let go of that thinking. The filmmaking, all of that was all about trying to think about these societal conditions and what really can we do to try and change them. And so obviously, after 2 years of thinking about it, thinking about policy, and, at the time I started helping out with a campaign in Philadelphia, it was very exciting and hopeful. And, something in my gut told me things are going to really change. And now's the time. And I just remember being at the inauguration being like, I think I really need to help this administration. And I came home, I told my mom, at that point, I was about to take actually a position, a staff physician position at Penn, actually at an adolescent HIV clinic. And I told her, I'm just going to apply for this thing. We'll see what happens. And I ended up getting it. And that was a whole, 3-year experience of, and healthcare policy was on the front line. And so it was really a chance to jump in and do something about something, an issue I'd been thinking so hard and closely about.
So was it very impactful?
Yeah, definitely. I mean,
worth it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I'm someone who's defined myself in terms of thinking about my advocacy and activism as definitely someone who works outside of the system. So it was incredibly eye-opening to work within government. And I think government is a space that everyone should spend some time in, regardless of what you do.
Yeah,
because I really think it changes your thinking on almost everything.
Did you feel empowered by being a White House Fellow that you could make change?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, we did. There were many things that happened, right? I mean, at the end of the day, know, I mean, I was working on a set of issues. In particular, I was working on veterans' mental health issues,
yes,
which were a giant
huge
mess. I was also working on health disparities, which, you know, the country for the first time, it was an effort called the Federal Interagency Health Equity Team, FIHET, released its first strategy to try and think through how America can eliminate health disparities, which has never been done before. You know, you have to have a plan before you can actually get to the outcome. The White House Fellowship is only 1 year, and I ended up staying at the VA. So I was there from 2009 to 2012 when we shot Defret.
Now we're going to move to that movie. What's the genesis of Defret?
There's a story behind the story.
Yes, well, I want both.
The story is about a very famous legal precedenting court case in Ethiopia that outlawed the kidnapping of child brides. So in Ethiopia, like in many parts of the world, young girls are abducted, often under very violent conditions, with the purposes of marrying them off.
The family gets money.
The family doesn't get money, at least not in the case of Ethiopia, per se. Yeah.
It's just
security. Well, it's security for the girl, right? I mean, thinking, you know, security for the girl and her future.
Okay.
But the practice is actually called Elefa. This young Ethiopian girl named Abarashbek Ella in 1996 ended up shooting and killing her abductor, who had also raped her, and standing trial for the first time, she was being charged with murder.
Let me interrupt. The abductor was not her future husband, or
was her future husband.
Okay.
I mean, they just pick who they want based on whatever criteria. I don't think there's a set way that they necessarily do it.
And how old was she when she was abducted?
14.
14. Okay.
She was 14, and she ended up killing and shooting him and being charged with murder.
Right.
At the time, there was a young kind of legal aid organization called the Ethiopian Women's Lawyers Association that was started by a pretty amazing lawyer named Maaza Shannafi. So when they heard about this case, Iola took the case on and represented the young girl in court.
Because this was an anomaly. And while young girls were abducted, nobody ever took matters into their own hands.
No one had challenged it like Avarash had. It had never happened before. And so it was like a 2-year court battle. And at the age of 16, she became the first woman to claim self-defense in a court of law and win in Ethiopia.
Stunning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it led to all these legal changes actually in the laws as well. Gender-based violence got defined as a crime for the first time in history. And there was a strengthening of the laws because there was this loophole whereby if a man abducted a girl, if he married her, then there was no punishment. So thanks to Abarash's case, they closed that loophole and it became punishable by a 5-year prison sentence. And so it was this amazing story. And I didn't know anything about it, quite frankly. And what had happened is I was speaking at a health and human rights conference in LA, actually. And at this time, I was doing all this work around the outreach for All of Us and was speaking all over the place.
For the documentary
had aired on TV, on Showtime. And the writer-director of Defret, a filmmaker by the name of Zerasanai Berhane Mahari, approached me in L.A. With the script. He was born and raised in Ethiopia, and he actually got a lottery visa to come to the States and ends up at USC Film School, as one does after a lottery visa, and was working in Hollywood for like 10 years, but was always going back to Ethiopia looking for a story to tell for his first feature. And he found the story, wrote an amazing script. And in Hollywood, they actually offered him a lot of money for the script, but they wanted it in English. They also wanted non-Ethiopian actors, and they wanted, you know, stars. And it was kind of the opposite of everything he had envisioned for the film.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had heard about me and my work and that I do kind of alternative financing on films. And so he brought the script to me. And when I read it, I was just blown away by it.
And what year was this?
This is 2009.
Okay.
I was still in Philadelphia. And I told Lacey, there's a script. We have to, you know, read it. And Lacey had the same reaction to the script. She's like, yeah, let's totally do this film. And so we started on the film in 2009.
Started as in fundraising?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Starting production. Mm-hmm. You know, signed on as producers and really thinking through, you know, how we were going to fund this plan.
And how did you fund this plan?
It was a labor of love, piecemeal, because
Kickstarter?
Yeah. There were 2 different Kickstarter campaigns. We did kind of art auctions in New York and in London. And I approached every kind of rich Ethiopian person I could know to find an investor, and we got lucky. We found an Ethiopian-American painter named Julie Mehratu, who ended up being our equity, her and her partner,
who's
Jessica
here
Rankin.
In the States?
Yeah, she's based in New York City, actually. She's a wonderful abstract painter. internationally acclaimed visual artist in her own right. And she signed on to the project and, you know, gave us enough of the money to have a shooting budget, essentially. And we continued to kind of fundraise for about 3 years. It took us 3 years to get the money together.
What did you need money-wise?
$850,000.
That doesn't seem excessive.
No, but when you're doing it piecemeal and crowdsourcing it, it's actually quite a lot to try and do. I mean, our biggest issue is that the director wanted to make this film on film. It was shot on 35mm film, which is, it's only the fourth film in Ethiopia ever shot on 35mm, and partly because Ethiopia doesn't have film labs. So that meant we had to ship our film to India, the dailies, to get it processed and come back. So the costs of all of it were pretty significant. And then if you add, you know, runners and visas and making sure customs
officials. And going back and forth. And
if
the entire cast is Ethiopian?
The entire cast is Ethiopian.
And how did you cast the young girl?
Casting was 8-month process, actually. Most of them were non-actors. The young girl was the hardest part to find.
Because she's the movie.
And also because in Ethiopia, they don't really write roles for young people. And, you know, there's a big theater tradition, but not a lot of parts for kids. And so we ended up flyering a lot of schools. And actually, we almost had to delay production because it was 2 weeks out. We still hadn't found her. And Zarasan and I finally did this last-ditch effort. He had heard this old theater actor was giving theater workshops at a school. And so he said, well, before we delay the date, let's just try this one place. He goes, and as luck would have it, it's in his old elementary school.
Oh, that's crazy.
He's, like, driving there. He's like, wait a minute. And there in his, like, you know, sixth grade class was this, was Tizita, was the girl. And he saw her, and he knew right away. He's like, I think we found her. But it was a very long process to find her. I think we must have seen something like 3,000 people to find her.
Wow.
Yeah.
How long was filming?
Filming, we were scheduled for 36 days, and we did it in 34.
Is that stunning that it was just a month?
Yeah, yeah. It was a very aggressive
And you spent
schedule.
That month in Ethiopia. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Dr. Merit Mandefro, who is a primary care physician, anthropologist, and filmmaker. Now, let's get a little personal here about you and the director.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, what do you mean, yeah, sure? Who's the director?
Yeah, no. The director is my husband.
Little nepotism going on in DeFret.
Not quite, because I really was his producer first.
And that's the way it should be, damn it.
Yeah, I was actually quite resistant to the whole idea. It was about 2.5 years into the whole production that we ended up getting married. But yeah, it's been a labor of love.
Great parallel to all of this, right?
Yeah.
You know, you've got this massive project going on, and the parallel to this is that you're falling in love.
Yeah.
Two people are falling in love. That should be shot as this was being shot, right?
Yeah, no, it makes it, like I said, a labor of love on multiple levels.
Literally,
because I also got pregnant with my son, with our son. Like, you know, my first day of pregnancy was like the first day of the shoot. Like, it was almost in tandem, literally. So we joked that we had twins, you know, the film and Lucas.
We gave birth to you. Yeah, right. That's wild. That's wild.
And fast forward, you know, we now have a daughter. And yeah.
So tell me what you think of the film.
The film is exactly what I thought it could be, you know, when I read the script. And I think for any filmmaker, that's always the challenge. You have a vision of what it can be. And the question is, can you execute? And in the case of film, because of how resource intensive it is, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find any other art form that requires more money than film. And so especially when it's like independent storytelling from the African continent, there's just not that many resources for those kinds of stories for a lot of reasons. And so that was the worry. Will we have the resources to execute on the vision? And I'm very happy to say we did, you know. And we were able to also have enough creative control to do it the way we wanted to do it.
And what's the connection with Angelina Jolie? How did she get involved?
Right. So after we finished the film, it was like about a month before we were going to premiere, Julie and I, our executive producer, were talking about, you know, how can we give this film a chance? As you know, there's many amazing films that are made every year that just
Nobody sees the light of day.
And because while we were trying to get film financing, we had encountered so much difficulties around kind of even the film grants telling us, you know, no one would want to see this story.
Yeah, here's my check, but what a waste.
Yeah, exactly. We were like, okay.
There's a steel hand in a velvet glove.
Right. So we were like, what can we do? And it was really Julie's like, you know, this really seems like something Angelina would support. And Julie had a collector who knew her, had a mutual friend with her, and was like, why don't we send the film to her? And I, honestly, I was like, sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I didn't even think about it. And then fast forward about 10 days later, she actually called Z. Like, we were sitting on the porch, and she actually called him.
Your husband.
My husband.
And hi, this is Angelina.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And was like, the film is amazing. You know, what mm-hmm. can I do to support? You know, what do you guys need? And at that point, financing was done. And so
what did you need?
Well, her name. Mm-hmm. And we asked for her name mm-hmm. and her support to help us break through a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, because when you don't have a studio behind you, trying to get any kind of press for stories like this is a challenge. And having her name obviously helps. And she's been a really wonderful supporter.
So it exists.
It exists.
Defret exists.
Yeah.
And it's on the big screen.
Yeah, it's in theaters all around the world. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be available digitally as well. Mm-hmm. And it exists in the world. It's amazing. And it's, you know, it's done very well. It was so much better than I thought it was going to do in many ways. You know, we made this film so much thinking about Ethiopia in mind, but it's translated much broader than just Ethiopia. And one of my favorite things has been to really go around to all of these different countries with the film and see the different reactions and hear the stories.
And how empowering it is, huh?
How empowering, but also just how many places have these same issues still in 2015, God,
yeah.
right? I mean,
yeah.
it's shocking how much like abduction and the issue of child marriage, how wide it is, how still, right? You know, and so just it also is just a reminder of how much work there is left to do. And if people want to learn more about the film, you can just go to defret.com, DIFRET.com, and learn all about it and see where it's playing in your area.
What's next for you and Truth Aid?
Yeah, so we are working on a documentary film mm-hmm. that with a director named Yura Barichin that is based on the book How It Feels to Be Free, which chronicles the story of Black women entertainers in the civil rights movement and the way they used politics as a political, you know, their art as a political force, both on stage and off stage. So we're working on that.
Detail that a little bit more. Cover what years?
The story is about, you know, well, it's looking at Lena Horne, Cicely Tyson, uh-huh. Diane Carroll, mm-hmm, you mm-hmm. know, Nina Simone, Mary McCabe is also in the book. We're not going to do all of those profiles. We're probably going to pick two of the three mm-hmm. women and follow it out. But it's this real story of how women have used art as a political force. Which I think is a really interesting
conversation. Does it have a title?
How It Feels to Be Free.
How
it's
right,
based
you said.
On, yeah,
on the book.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
a book by Ruth Feldstein. So Lacey and I are working on that, and we're also developing our first feature script that we're going to co-direct. And
can you share anything about that, or are you going to play that close to the vest?
I'm going to play that close to the vest. That's the struggle of work-life balance, told with some comedy. And a modern day twist.
Do you and your husband plan to work together a lot?
We do. I'm working on a film with him as well.
Uh-huh.
Two films. One is looking at the issue of trafficking. You know, my husband continues to pick very lighthearted subjects. It's intriguing. There's about 11 million stateless people in this world that live in between the borders of countries and it's kind of like the fourth world.
Well, look what's going on in the world today.
Exactly.
Oh, my God.
Right.
Refugee
crisis,
issue.
Crisis,
yes.
Right. And so it's a story about that, and it's told through the eyes of a young journalist who kind of uncovers a trafficking ring. So that's one film I'm working on with him.
So the medical part of your life is kind of on hold?
At this point, my kids kind of changed everything, mm-hmm. to tell you the
truth.
They
often do.
Yeah, I have two kids, and it's just not enough hours in a day, you know? So mm-hmm. I've stopped teaching, and I'm not doing anything in the medical world right now, but which well, slightly not true, because I'm still, you know, I helped start this health technology company called Amida Technology, and I was chief medical officer.
Oh, okay.
Of Amida. Mm-hmm. And so medicine is my first home. It's my first disciplinary home. I'll always think of myself as a doctor, you know, and doctor in its broadest sense, taking care of people. I tell people all the time that, you know, I decided you didn't have to be sick anymore to talk to me, which is why I stopped practicing, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think truly what a healer does at the end of the day is teach people about their lives, right? I mean, a really good primary care doctor, that's what you do.
That's right.
You intervene and you really try to get people to understand something about themselves and about kind of how they're living their life. And I think I continue to do that. That's the thread I chase in all of the different activities that
well,
I do.
Well, the way you live your life is inspiring, and it's been nothing short of my pleasure to get to meet you, Merit. You're a force to be reckoned with, and aren't we lucky to have you in our lives? Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.